This podcast is part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Programme and is brought to you with the support of BPI France. You're listening to the FinTech Podcast, the show that goes deep into the stories, the successes and failures that went into creating some of the world's most fantastic fintechs. And in this episode, how Railsbank co-founder Nigel Verdon survived the perfect storm before sailing on to found three fintechs.
They all got on deck to find these massive 30-foot bank swells around the boat. Huge, biggest sea I've ever seen in my life. And then the captain just orders us to get the damn sails down. It's not like in a yacht where they just collapse. You've actually got to go out into the rigging and go and take the sails down. Did that and was out there in the bowsprit one way out over the sea, so going up and down 30 to 60 feet. And Dave Hyatt, the first mate, and I both forgot to clip on. So it's all out there with no harnesses or anything else on that, getting the sails down, because we knew that the next day if the sails shred, we'd be stitching about things.
Nigel Verdon, co-founder and CEO of Railsbank, thanks so much for joining me on the FinTech Podcast.
Thank you for the invitation. It's great to be invited, and thank you again.
So you're a banking as a service platform. What exactly does that mean in practice?
That means in practice, we're a platform that enables any fintech or brand to launch financial products, whether that be a sort of banking type product, would be wealth management products, would be payment products, whether it be rewards type products. And so banking services is a bit sort of a catch-all. I'd say we're more a financial embedded finance platform that enables anybody to embed financial services into their existing customer journeys. Not white label or anything, but deeply embedded.
Right, so whether you're a bank or a fintech or maybe just a normal tech company that wants to incorporate certain financial abilities into their platform, they can come to you and you can help them out.
Although we don't sell to banks, some of them partner with us at the back end, but we don't actually sell to banks. It's primarily brands and fintech, so people in like retail, fast moving to consumer goods, travel. And then the normal fintechs that you see from time to time. We do work with neobanks, but not the traditional banks.
Okay, so if I wanted to set up the Bank of Elliot, and I said, you know, hey, Nigel, I want to create my own neobank, how easy would that be for me to launch on your platform? What would I need to do, and how much would I have to pay you? How would it work?
So it's super easy to launch. You could prototype now using one of our sandboxes with real money. And you could do that without even talking to us. There's APIs up there, there's documentation, and you can create a number of accounts. I think it's about 20 accounts. You can do payments of up to €5. So you can create the full experience of a neobank within literally a week, prototyping. If you've got some developers who can prototype, then launch it generally in six to eight weeks. The fastest we've got to market was lightningaid.org during COVID, which was 8 days from the idea to the Apple App Store, live in the Apple App Store, a full neobank with a debit card in its brand.
So that was it. They got together, had an idea, let's do this. They came to you 8 days later, they launched on the App Store, and they're getting clients.
Correct. And that was rather intense 8 days. if you looked at the hours worked, it was more like a normal, I'd say 2 to 3 weeks of actual work, but it was condensed into 8 days.
And I assume obviously they had to work on their own branding and promotion and everything else in order to kind of, you know, because obviously you can create something. I'm sure there are lots of easy ways to get things on the App Store and no one will ever find them unless, you know, you kind of help them on their way.
The branding stuff had to be done, but you've got places like Fiverr, you can outsource tons of this. And this was basically something to help people, a certain demographic, during COVID when they were in lockdown, like vulnerable people who needed to be able to give somebody money to do shopping for them, for example, but didn't want to trust just giving cash. So it was a sort of like a neobank that helped people give funds, and charities give funds to vulnerable people, so people do shopping and other things on their behalf during lockdown.
Wow. And they had I know it's not your company, but I mean, they had a good launch. They achieved like a decent number of customers in order to make them viable.
Yeah, it's now there's another charity buying it over and taking on part of it. We put some of our own time into it. My co-founder put a lot of his time. So it's done in partnership with a third party as well. Now it's going to, and actually help the music industry too. There was an issue where, because all the roadies are self-employed and the government at the time didn't pay self-employed people because they couldn't prove certain things. A couple of well-known individuals in the music industry approached us, I've known one of them for many, many years, and set up a platform where they put their personal money in so roadies could be paid through this platform as well, and they could spend on certain things. And then when government came later on, they could claim back the funds from government. So it's a social enterprise more than anything. And it's going to hopefully go into one of our colleagues. She's actually left her business now, and she set up her own social impact business. And we're likely to donate the platform and any pieces that we still own intellectual property to that.
Okay, well, I know that music is something that's close to your heart, so we'll come back to that later on in our conversation. But I assume the last 12 to 18 months, I mean, you just gave us one example of one client that you helped during the pandemic. Presumably the past 12 to 18 months must have been pretty good period for you guys.
Yeah, we've grown the past 18 months from literally 97 people to 420 people. So it's been, I think, it's a sort of shift to digital. And digital product, digital processes was, and compared to the sort of what they called old finance or world where everything is still fairly analog, where generally a process has become a PDF, but that's not digital. It's just making the process digitized as opposed to digital. So it's really shown over these past 18 months business models that are pure digital are taking over much, much faster than traditional financial services business models. And they've got a huge amount of traction because of that, even launching new ones within it. So it's been quite a roller coaster over the past 18 months with lockdown growing at a huge rate in the company. And also we acquired Wirecard at the time, and we had Brexit. So everything was there. But a very tired team are just about recovering now, halfway through 2021.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that because I think in this period you also raised, I think, $37 million and you bought Wirecard's UK assets. What was the rationale behind that purchase?
One of the reasons was Wirecard going bust did not help the fintech industry full stop trust-wise. And so that didn't help a lot of our customers and also the industry in general. So there's one, two, to help the industry. Number two is there was a ton of good people in Wirecard that the skills that we needed in Wales Bank. So there was a number of people, and number three, there was clients as well. Some clients we know very, very well from previous lives and other new ones that we brought on board. So the economics worked. And the publicity was superb. I think I could have probably spent the same amount we paid for Wirecard on PR and advertising and got less coverage. So it was good. So generally, those are the four motivations on it. And I will say that people from Wirecard should still stand proud because there were several thousand very good people at Wirecard let down by a few. So, to appeal to anybody else in the industry is just hire people from Wirecard. They're good people. There's nothing wrong with them.
And there were no concerns that there might still be some skeletons in the closet, like that some of the assets you bought might still have problems, legacy problems, or your lawyers ensured that if there are any issues, they won't come back to haunt you?
No, we're quite experienced with previous lives at M&A and how it can go right and wrong. And one of the key things is we didn't actually buy the legal entity where there was stuff in there. We bought just the assets, clients, and the people transferred over to us under 2P, the UK regulation for transfer of staff. So we minimise that risk by not buying the legal entity. not having to take any of the liability with that legal entity, so we didn't need it. So it's just literally the assets, which are tiny bit of technology, the customers that are contracts innovated over, and a number of the team came over to us under 2P legislation.
And any more acquisitions planned?
We will be, and we've got our eyes on a few things and talking to a few things and be announced over the next 2 to 3 months. Because it's number one is we've got a great platform that customers have been migrated to. We've migrated Wirecard in, I think it was 3.5-4 weeks. So the team are used to have that machine ready to bring other businesses on board. And it's just learned from our days in sort of like 1990s, et cetera, where we had a lot of experience on mergers and acquisitions and lived through them in previous lives. And Chipper on our board actually led the transaction. He was responsible for eBay buying Skype. He led that transaction.
Okay. Well, let's hope that ultimately it proves more of a good acquisition than Skype proved for eBay. In terms of, you talked about, you know, your expansion in terms of headcount. I think you said what, from like 90 people, was it, to like more than 400? Yeah. I can't remember. In terms of traction, in terms of customers, in terms of revenue growth, can you give us an indication of what you experienced?
Sure. Our revenue growth has been, the past 2 years, over 100% per year, which is good. The customers, now around 300 odd customers, and that's been growing. So the two are growing very nicely and steeply. And that's both in UK, Europe, which is our main business. Southeast Asia has taken off, and we're now got revenue in there in Singapore and Australia. And US launch, we have customers signed up, and they will be announced imminently as well.
Well, I'm glad you mentioned some of these other markets that you're in, because you're pretty young fintech, although with the greatest of respect, you're probably not the youngest fintech founder that we've had on the show. You've got an incredible geographic spread, including, I think, part of the US, Singapore, Lithuania, Manila, Melbourne, to name a few. Fintechs often go after one market to start with. Okay, let's conquer the EU, then maybe we'll think about the US, or we'll then think about China, or whatever the case may be. So I'm just wondering how you've managed to gain such a geographic spread in such a short space of time, and what's behind your approach in contrast perhaps to other banking as a service platforms or embedded finance fintechs?
Sure. I mean, consumer businesses, it makes sense to go one market at a time. B2B and infrastructure like AWS and others, you tend to go multi-jurisdiction because your customers are multi-jurisdiction, and that's the drive for us is customers wanted not only to get into business fast, launch an idea fast, or prototype it fast, but our customer journey is prototype, launch, and scale. And they also wanted to scale across geographies, and especially when talking to larger brands who are present in different countries, they don't want to talk to 3 or 4 vendors, they want to talk to one. And so some of the biggest tech companies in the world we've had discussions with. So how do we do that? I was lucky enough, I think you need grey hair to do it. And understand the markets.
Check.
Okay. My team have all got grey hair. We've been working together, our core team. I've founded 3 companies. One's on the FTSE 100 now as part of BAE Systems. Second one was Currency Cloud. My core team have been some of them been with me since our very first company, including my co-founder. So we're used to executing stuff together, which is good. And a lot of us have been brought up all over the world, and that really does matter because once you understand the market, you can understand how to develop your business in there. So I'm Irish, I'm born in Germany, I was brought up in Southeast Asia, I've lived pretty much all over the world before I was even 18, so father's in the military. And so experiencing those different cultures helps understand how you build businesses. For example, one US, large US company, I remember being in Singapore and not figuring out that Singapore is fundamentally different from Indonesia, Philippines, from Vietnam, mainland China, Hong Kong, and everything. They're fundamentally different markets and religions and people and everything, and they hadn't figured that out. To operate in Philippines and Indonesia, it's best to work in joint venture with one of the local families because they know their market extremely well, rather than go in blind and say we're here and announce yourselves. They're more JV markets. If you look at WeWork went direct in Western markets and joint ventured in emerging markets. That's the only way you can develop emerging markets, because they're fundamentally different with pitfalls. Things can change radically. Political power switches between places. And they're less stable in terms of sort of legal system and everything else on that. And you've got to work with local, the local joint venture to figure out how to survive through that, because they know how to do it.
So you're in all of these international markets. You've experienced tremendous growth, especially over the last 12 to 18 months. What's the actual business model? When I set up the Bank of Elliott and I go using your platform, whether it takes me 8 days or a couple of weeks, do I pay you up front just for the service? Am I paying you a proportion of my revenues? How does it actually work?
Initially, there's a setup fee, which is just it's a very nominal fee. Then a subscription fee to whichever services you're using, which is our technology, our operations, our banking capability, our card capability. And then above subscriptions, depending on your usage, that starts transactional fees on a per transaction basis. So it's very simple. One of the things we pride ourselves in the actual pricing sheet is a piece of A4, no more than that. And our competitors are generally about 10 to 20 pages of unfathomable sort of economics you've got to go through, and have an accountant going through to figure out how much you're actually paying. We just try and make it very simple. We learned that. I learned that in Currency Cloud. I think Stripe did it when they first launched acquiring at 2%. I think it was just, okay, that's what I've got to pay. Whether you're expensive or not, it's a different matter. It's super simple. And why is that important to customers? Some of our customers are startups, some are very well-established brands. If you're a startup, you've got to justify yourself to your investors. Therefore, you want simple economics to go into your planning, your business modeling yourself, to show to your investors. And so if we make our pricing super simple, they can then, it's a simple task for them to convince their investors. And it's only one pricing sheet. They then have to integrate a bin sponsor, car manufacturer, appraiser, all that other stuff that's just turnkey and simple for them. And the same for larger brands is they can prototype with us super fast. We don't try and put them into a 3 to 5 year contract like a lot of competitors do. We just say, if you sign up and pay as you go until you've prototyped, you've got data, and with super simple pricing that you can then take to your head of marketing or your head of product and say, here's our data with real customers. We've spent a small amount on it here. This is it. We can invest this. We can then grow this product as well. So it's like all businesses, friction and digital, and removing friction and being digital is not just technology. It's to do with pricing. It's to do with how people operate and everything. A classic one is Amazon. It has a hell of a lot of tech, but it's fundamentally a logistics and logistics business and marketplace with good technology and good digital processes running it. And that's what makes the big difference is digital processes. And they can still have people doing them. It's the mindset of removing friction.
You mentioned how expanding internationally was second nature for you, given all of the countries you lived in, because of, I think you said your father was in the military. Was some of that kind of military discipline, do you think, kind of handed down to you, enabling you to run, you know, this just to found different companies and now to be heading up Rails Bank and expanding internationally? Does it require military discipline? Is that something that's in the blood and that helps you manage such businesses?
Well, my co-founder was a lieutenant commander when he left the Royal Navy, nuclear weapons officer. My head of operations was an officer in the Highlanders Regiment. I protected the Queen once up in Balmoral and kicked a corgi by mistake, which is a thing one doesn't do. So it's a discipline thing, whether it's military or not. It's about understanding where you're going, setting direction, being super clear on it, and focusing on what's important rather than the next spotty thing that's coming along. And sometimes it's just you've got to keep refocusing people, reminding them where the focus is and where the direction is, and let them get on with executing and delivering on it. Because if you give people direction, I find And as again, it's a growing up thing. We're committed to all our teams now that as founders, we will not get involved in any process anymore. If you've hired smart people, they'll figure stuff out as long as you give them direction. So it's all about direction. And same in the military, you've got different people understanding different parts of the scenario that you're operating under. And you've got people giving direction and then people giving feedback. And you rely on your people to do the right thing at the moment in time because they're right in the middle of that process or that customer. And if they've got the right direction, they can get on with it and make their own decisions.
And I have to ask, when you kicked the Queen's Corgi, was it an accident? Was it kind of just yapping too much?
My head of operations, I think it was an accident. He says it was an accident.
Okay, well, if Her Majesty's listening, it was definitely an accident. So, Nigel, your Twitter bio reads, 25 plus years in fintech, founded Evolution in 96 and Currency Cloud in 2007 and Railsbank 2016, sailor, guitar player, builder, and kick-ass curry cook. Where should we start? Which of these kind of defines you best? I'm intrigued to know about the sailing, the guitar playing, and unfortunately you're in a different country, so I can't experience your curry, so I'll take your word for it on that count. But tell me a bit more about the founder, the co-founder and CEO of Railsbank.
Yeah, the curries, my father commanded one of the Gurkha regiments in the British Army, so I was brought up on Nepalese food and eating it at home as well. And also a ton of time when in Southeast Asia is in army camps, and you ate the Nepalese food a lot because it was every Sunday you had lunch there. The sailing and guitar sort of related. I screwed up my A levels at school because I used to spend all my time playing guitar and playing rugby and not doing much schooling, and because of that I actually failed my level, so I wasn't going to university. So I then I've been sailing since I was 3 years old, and again, various parts of the world, in the Baltic, South China Sea, the Atlantic, the Channel, the Irish Sea, all over. And I actually became a professional sailor on a tall ship that sailed between Maine and South Carolina. So it was a replica of the first ship of the US Navy, Providence. The captain, again, it's another music thing, captain, original captain of it, so I was called John Paul Jones, who was the first admiral of the US Navy in the 1676 or 76, whatever it was when the Civil War was there. He was also the bassist of Led Zeppelin, it was John Paul Jones. So two John Paul Jones, very different eras and very different jobs. So I worked there, and I still do a ton of sailing as well. Mountaineering, those are the things, a very outdoors person. But my father convinced me, because I phoned him after being at sea for 3 weeks, sorry, 3 months, from Newport, Rhode Island. And he convinced me, look, I'll pay for a tutor to help you retake your exams. And my father didn't go to university either. So he said, please just spend 3 years having fun, pass your exams, and then you can go back to sailing if you want, and things. But I did. I had an amazing tutor. A Swedish guy called Brad Severtsson, who taught us the first principles of maths rather than teaching us how to pass exams. And that was a great experience. He got me and three other guys who had similar backgrounds. They'd either played sport too much and didn't pay much attention to class. And he got all of us straight A's in our A level. So that it's telling what a teacher, the influence as a real learning thing that teachers, the right teacher, can stimulate anybody. And ended up at university. I got two engineering degrees now, and then went to start life as an engineer. And ended up in finance by mistake. So my best buddy, one of the engineers at a place called EDS, was owned by General Motors. He phoned me up and said he's joining a place called Goldman Sachs, and I'd never heard of these people, and I'd never heard of investment banking or trading or anything. I thought that he put a card in the wall, and cash came out. That was most advanced thing of banking. But you just say they pay you 20 times the money for the same maths. So I ended up in the city myself as well.
Wow. Amazing story. I want to come back to that in just a moment, Nigel. So don't go away, because I just need to remind our listeners that this podcast is part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Program for 2021. And in this special pandemic period, you can enjoy throughout the year top-level live sessions with key industry players, exclusive on-demand interviews such as this one, and use our innovative digital networking capabilities to meet your peers, develop your network, create new business opportunities, and continue to build together the future of the fin and tech industry. And you can find out more at www.parisfintechforum.com. So, Nigel, we were just talking about how you fell into finance by mistake. I'm not sure if you gave us the full lowdown on your guitar playing, though. Did you played in a band? Did you ever have ambitions of emulating the namesake of the first U.S. Navy captain, the bassist from Led Zeppelin?
Yeah, sure. I played in bands all through my teens and university as well. When I was 18, after I had failed my A-levels, before I went sailing, I said to my father I was going to be a professional musician. And he said to me, just don't tell your mother. I think it was his way of saying, you're okay, but you're not as good as your buddies. Your buddies are really, really, really talented. And so one of my friends, the guy I played with, a guy called Ben Pope, who was taught piano by a guy called John Ogden, who's the premier sort of classical pianist of the last century. Ben now conducts the Royal Philharmonic, the Royal Ballet, Belgian Philharmonic and everything. Another one, Johnny Pumphrey, is now a well-renowned session musician and saxophone player. But it was, so I have played in bands. I still sort of jam with friends of mine. We have come over to the garden here and they get the amps and guitars out. Both my daughters play and I've geeked with them a couple of times as well. So yeah, it's been a big thing of life, music. It's a pleasure. I collect the guitars, I build them, play them, and it's a great thing to socialise with friends and go and see gigs and everything.
And you don't just, when you say you collect guitars, you've got more than a couple, right?
It's got around 37 or so at the moment. Various things. Some are collectibles. Some are just old things that I had knocking around. Some are built stuff I built myself, and others are. People donated them because they decided they needed a good home.
But in terms of your musical ambitions, they kind of, when your father spoke to you and kind of said, go for it, but, you know, implying that you're not as good as your friends, that was when you realized that maybe a musical career wasn't for you, or you still kind of went down that route as far as you could until reality bit?
Yeah, I didn't really go career-wise. I went down it more just enjoyment-wise. Enjoyed it as a hobby type of thing, rather than the sort of stress of working in it. Friends, again, I've got a ton of friends who still work in the industry and are very, very well-known individuals. And it's their story of getting paid, sort of like going from town to town when they're on tour and everything. It's quite a brutal lifestyle. As well, and if you make it, you can get some good money out of it. But a ton of them were they've even had recordings in various charts and been near the top of some of the charts. They still aren't. They're still artists. They still get paid like artists, which is a shame because of the entertainment they give to so many people.
And so, Nigel, you've told us you fell into finance by mistake. I think you said you went to Goldman Sachs, or at least your friend convinced you to go into banking because of the pay. At what point did you realize, you know, this is all good, I'm getting a good wage, but actually, you know, I want to set something up on my own? When did this realization dawn on you?
I went to Nomura and then Swiss Bank Corp, which is today called UBS. My colleague went to Goldman. The internet was a thing that changed everything in the mid-1990s. And the team I was with in Swiss Bank Corp did the very first foreign exchange trades on the internet between Swiss Bank Corp and Jyske Bank. And that was a sort of, within that team, we were thinking, okay, this is something interesting. Let's go and build a company that does this for other businesses too. So we ended up with Swiss Bank or UBS as a client, Goldman Sachs as a client, Morgan Stanley, Merrill Lynch, and a lot of that market. So we're like a miniature Accenture for utilizing, sort of transforming your front office and your trading, in primarily in FX and equities, over this thing called the internet. And so my buddy from Goldman Sachs came and joined me, and another friend from Goldman Sachs, and another friend from university. And our CTO then was my co-founding CTO at Currency Cloud and the chief architect at Wells Bank. My co-founder was a part of that team, and he worked for Evolution, then worked for PwC, and then came back to work in Wells Bank. Pete Buckney, our CTO in Wells Bank, was also a project manager in those days, the same team. So there's a ton of us who all went to that thing. We just thought, hey, let's go build something rather than just be we were quite sort of entrepreneur-minded type individuals, the four of us who founded Evolution. And we both get, also the four of us again, a bit frustrated working sort of a general day job. We wanted something that could fit around our lives as well, like selfishly, because two of us did tons of paragliding. One was a major cyclist as well, and the other one was another mountain, a sort of real mountains guy. So we wanted to do something that worked around our lives as well. And so that's what we did. We took a plunge. That business wasn't funded or anything. We bootstrapped it. It was profitable year one. We won all sorts of awards, fastest growing companies in the UK, entrepreneurs of the year. We were semi-finalist in it. So it's a great company.
This was Evolution, this was your first startup. And so you had and then you sold that business?
Yes, it's now part of BAE Systems, which is on the office of London, acquired it in 2006.
And then almost immediately you went and founded Currency Cloud, which, tell us about that. How did that go? What was the idea there?
In 2003, I'd stepped down from an operational role that I just stayed on the board of Evolution. I was actually then dragged into a bank by an old friend of mine from Swiss Bank Corp to help them turn around the equities business of Desmond Trimble. And in 2005, we did that in 18 months, from a 90 million loss to 120 million profit, because of just stopping them doing stupid things, is the simplest answer. Then met a guy called Sean Park, if you know Antimus, it's one of the premier fintech funds, the very first fintech funds. Sean was running a business, just started collecting together a business in Dresden Kleinwald called Digital Markets. And had a conversation with him and said, I can bring all the equity pieces in there, direct market access, the market making platform for retail market making and London Stock Exchange. And so we built that business over 2 years, and then Dresner fired us all, which is very public in newspapers. And I think it's quite funny, the head of fixed income, an Australian guy, name escapes me now, ex-JP Morgan, he successfully sued them for being racist to an Australian. And then he gave the money to charity because Dresner just got itself in a bit of a pickle, and that's why Commerzbank ended up buying them. But when we left, Sean set up Antimus. I put a tiny bit of money into that. I set up Currency Cloud because I was annoyed at, I was living in France at the time. I needed to transfer money over from my sterling to my euros, and some company was trying to charge me 4%. And the bid offer on that was something like two or three pips in those days. So it was nowhere near. It's like 4,000 times less. So I started looking at it, and then they sent me an email with a PDF to fill in by hand and then go and fax back to them with my payment instructions. Nearest fax was 10 miles away in the local village. So it was. I saw all this friction on it. So I got hold of my buddy Nick Warner from Evolution and said, "Hey, why don't we sort of automate this foreign exchange market like we did with the capital markets, where everything was straight through processing? This is a really archaic market, and it's overpriced, and there's no price transparency, and they try to rip you off and everything." So we started on that journey, and what we built was essentially a retail and a corporate foreign exchange platform, which was just before TransferWise launched. And when I met TransferWise guys over the PowerPoint deck, after introduced by Michael Jackson, who was the COO of Skype, and realized, God, these guys know retail, we don't. And we switched pretty quickly into being a platform business, an API-led business, And that's when it really took off, is when we made that change from being direct to consumer and direct to SME. We sold the direct to consumer one to Infinity FX and just concentrated on the API business. So it's that was the reason why I was basically annoyed at somebody overcharging me and seeing a market that was so inefficient, and that annoyed me to fax something back to somebody.
Right. So was it David Banner turns green and turns into the Hulk, but if you annoy Nigel, he goes off and sets up a fintech and simplifies the process. So I guess that's a good way of channeling your anger and annoyance. So you talked about some of the companies you founded, Evolution, Currency Cloud, obviously Rails Bank right now. They all seem to have done remarkably well. I'm just wondering, were there no failures along the way? Nothing, no kind of setbacks that made you think maybe this wasn't for you, or made you dust yourself off and dust yourself down and start off again?
No, I invested in a private jet business years ago, and me and all the other investors all lost money on that completely, because the lesson there was only invest in something you understand. It was a business I just didn't understand. It was a colleague. It looked good at the time, so that was a wrong decision. So on reflection, I only do anything from an investment side within the fintech world, because I know it deeply can help influence outcomes from investing in it. So that was a sort of setback. On the same thing on Currency Cloud, when we first started it, going direct to consumer and direct to SME was a real eye-opener of having to the dynamics of a direct consumer business when we just come from capital markets, which is a institution business. And so we really didn't understand it. So we figured out quite quickly, trying to get a customer at a time was a really, really difficult thing to do, unless you had the skills to do that, like TransferWise and Revolut as successful companies. And so the sort of the learning there was, let's transform into what we know, which is platform institution to institution, and make sure that we have a sort of robust way of straight through processing. And that's what founded on Currency Cloud. So it's learning. It's not everything's perfect on that. Other ones on, I guess as general, been on the way that customers only buy value propositions. They don't buy your features. Is another one of how you market. You'll see Rails Bank is very much marketed on value proposition of access global banking of 5 lines of code. And rather than, you can make payments and things. And another learning was Currency Cloud is in the payment space, and that's massively crowded, so very difficult to differentiate. Whereas the word payments is banned in Rails Bank, so we never get painted in that space. So, when we talk to the media and everything, it's very clear that we're in a clear space. And the learning in Currency Cloud there was, if you're in a crowded market, it's very difficult to get out of it unless you define a new category. And Rails Bank, we're very much about defining a new space of the market, whether it's bank as a service or embedded finance, of where we were operating. We use language that's clear to that. And position that well away from payments. We do payments with even all banks do payments, but they're not called payments companies. And so that's a big learning. It's about positioning, it's about value proposition, it's about knowing what you're good at and what you're not good at as well.
And I guess succeeding also requires you to roll with the punches and challenges that come your way, such as, for example, Brexit in the UK. I think, if I'm not mistaken, Rails Bank is still universally described as a London-based fintech. If you knew now kind of what you knew then before the whole Brexit experience, would you still set up shop with London as your HQ today?
Yes and no. The key thing is, I mean, London's very easy to operate from, but it's now a 60 million person market. If you're a total market, but again, you've got to say under 18s, they discount those. Whereas Europe, with the UK, was a 720 million, so 660 million market. So we're most likely set up somewhere else in Europe than London, although it's easier to operate in London than most other markets in Europe for many, many reasons. London's also still got an advantage of the venture monies there, the legal system's there, the lawyers are there, so the ecosystem, like you've got Silicon Valley, which is why it's successful coming out of Silicon Valley. It's all about the ecosystem, the skills, and the people. And in certain European countries, they just don't exist. Germany's good as well. France has got a smaller ecosystem that's reasonably okay. But the other ones are just doesn't exist at all. So it probably would have been London, but we would definitely considered other markets to operate from. Ireland, where all my family's from, we may have considered it, but when you look at Dublin, Dublin and traffic and everything else like that, and talent, because you're trying to fight with Google, Facebook, and everybody else is over there, MasterCard and everything, for startups, it's probably not the best environment because of the mass competition, and living in Dublin and driving around there is an absolute pain these days. It's the M25, but like friction-free and everything.
And I think, Nigel, you've also written about changes in capital gains tax as being something else that might reduce the UK's attractiveness from your perspective as an entrepreneur?
Sure. The UK have a great environment for stimulating startups and motivating founders and shareholders on it. And pretty much the motivating investors are still there with the EMI and SEIS and EIS schemes. But for founders, it's essentially a change of capital gains has become pretty persecutionary. Now, there's a lot of debate on that, saying, oh, well, your founders, all that type of thing. But just remember, when you start companies, you either take no salary or take minimal salaries because that's the right thing to do. And your gain is when you sell your shares later on. But when there's mooting of putting capital gains tax at the same rates as income tax, you do think, well, as a founder, why should I be in the UK? I can leave the business there, but I may happen to live somewhere else, which is a better environment for founders to live in. So I think that's something the UK government does need to, I think, reconsider their position of how to motivate people, especially to stay in the country. Number two is what the UK has is another advantage for staying in London is the Department of Trade and Industry, or the Department of Industry and Trade, which they keep changing their name. They've got this massive international network and incredibly helpful. Southeast Asia, they've been, and Natalie Black is the Her Majesty's Trade Commissioner there. They're very helpful at opening doors, educating on local markets, access to people. That is a great attraction for the UK. And I think because it's now such a small market, the UK reach, though, is attractive. And the influence that the UK reach has for such a small market, it's massive. And it's more than Germany, more than France, more than Italy and Spain, more than Europe as a whole. And that is attractive. And that's, I think that's why we did considering re-headquartering. And we are still remaining in the UK.
Okay. So, look, Nigel, we're kind of almost at the end of our allotted time, but I've got one final question to ask you, which is a question I put to everyone on the FinTech podcast. And I haven't primed you, so it'd be great to get the first thing that comes into your head. So what is the weirdest or craziest thing you've ever built or done in your life?
So going back to sailing, if you've seen a film called the Perfect Storm,
I have. It was a terrible film with George Clooney, right?
So the boat I worked on was about 200-300 miles south of that, and I remember waking up one during the night, and the water was just going far too fast past the hull, just from sound waves, and I heard all hands. We all got on deck to find these massive 30-foot like swells around the boat. Huge, biggest sea I've ever seen in my life. And then the captain just orders us to get the damn sails down. And it's not like on a yacht where they just collapse. You've actually got to go out into the rigging and go and take the sails down. Did that and was out there in the bowsprit that comes right the way out over the sea, so you're going up and down 30-60 feet, and we Dave Hyatt, the first mate, and I both forgot to clip on, so it's all out there. with no harnesses or anything else like that, getting the sails down, because we knew that the next day if the sails shred, we'd be stitching it down things. And it was all done by hand on that boat. But that was without thinking, and it's probably because we were massively trained, because we've been working on that boat for a number of months anyway, and we've been both sailing all our lives. We knew how to be stable on the rigging. It's a sort of a training kick term. But if you look at it on reflection, would I do that again? No. You find a dumb kid who's 18 to do it, like I was.
Right. Well, so you were kind of you survived the perfect storm. It seems if that's not a good training for business or being a fintech founder, I'm not sure what is. Nigel Verdon, really great way to end, but appreciate your taking the time to speak to me on the FinTech podcast. So Nigel Verdon, co-founder and CEO of Rails Bank, thanks so much for joining me today.
Thank you.
Entrepreneurs often describe multiple existential challenges hitting them at the same time as a perfect storm. But Nigel Verdon must surely be the only fintech founder to have gone through one in the literal sense. Of course, being able to keep calm in such trying circumstances can give you perspective when dealing with 30-foot swells like a financial crisis or a pandemic, enabling you to see through choppy seas to the destination that lies beyond. So thank you, Nigel Verdon, and thank you for listening to the FinTech podcast with me, Elliot Gotkin, now part of the Paris FinTech Forum Communities Programme. If you like what you heard, you can subscribe wherever you get your podcasts, and you can get updates and listen to all previous episodes via the website, www.parisfintechforum.com. If you have any comments, suggestions or feedback, you can find us on LinkedIn and on Twitter at ParisFinForum or at Elliot Gotkin. That's it from me. Thanks again to BPI France for sponsoring this podcast. We'll be back again next week for more of the best FinTech. Hope you'll join us again then. Bye-bye.